doctors fighting a war with no ammunition. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the risks doctors and nurses are facing as they treat patients exposed to the coronavirus and how you, the public, can help them. You can join us right now. Call us up. It's 549-2937. Then later, advice for families who have seniors in isolation. But first, coronavirus cases have topped 1,000 in Florida, doubling in just a few days. That includes 69 now in our area and 3 local deaths. 5 deaths reported, meanwhile, in Georgia just over the weekend. You might have seen that expanded testing for the virus got underway over the weekend in Jacksonville at 2 downtown sites. That testing at the federal site is now open to all ages. Duval County students are returning to school today, but they are online. No school in the physical buildings for now. And Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry says all of his news conferences will now be virtual as well, as he tries to practice what he preaches and encourage everyone to stay home and do social distancing. At the same time, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is under increasing pressure and criticism to close all state beaches and issue a shelter-in-place order for the entire Sunshine State. He has resisted doing that so far. Meanwhile, doctors and nurses treating patients are sending out increasingly dire warnings about the lack of masks and ventilators and other equipment in hospitals. The Duval County Medical Society was actually formed over 100 years ago in response to epidemics of smallpox, malaria, and yellow fever. Now, during this outbreak, they are working to support local physicians and inform the public, too. Dr. James St. George is president of the Duval County Medical Society, and he's on the phone. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. And for the time being, all our guests will be by phone as we practice social distancing here at WJCT. And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about the shortage of masks and ventilators in hospital and how that's going to affect patient care? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax, and our Facebook page is open too. Doctor, we've been hearing for a while now that doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals treating coronavirus patients are extremely concerned. Some of them are getting sick. Some have already died. They don't have enough masks. They don't have enough ventilators for patients. What are you hearing from your local physicians right now?
So there are many aspects to that question. Well, let's kind of break it down. So the first component of that is what we call personal protective equipment, or for short, PPE. These are masks, and more specifically, a very special kind of mask called an N95 mask, which is more of a mask that securely fits over the face, and there's no openings on the side, and it filters very small particles down to the size of viruses. These are in very short supply. Impervious gowns, we've all seen images on TV of people wearing these full-body jumpsuits with goggles and face masks. All this is necessary to protect the provider in the emergency room in the hospital. These are individuals on the front line who are daily, not even daily, by the minute, exposed potentially to people infected with the virus. So they, of course, have to protect themselves so they can continue treating patients. So there is a shortage of these items, certainly because just the sheer demand nationwide and globally, but to some degree because the public is purchasing many of these products and it doesn't really serve them. We all are out in the public and we see individuals wearing these standard, say, surgical face masks, and that's not helping them. These masks are not designed to fit airtight over the face. They pucker on the sides when you wear them. And particles, respiratory particles, virus can certainly, they can breathe that in just like they would if they weren't wearing the mask. That's not helping them. Masks are worn by surgeons to prevent infecting the patient. So if you are doing an open procedure, you wear that mask so your respiratory droplets don't infect a wound or a surgical incision. It's not helping the lay public. So these products are in shortage. As they're in shortage, the hospital is invoking protocols to limit their use. For example, a provider may only get one mask for the shift or even multiple shifts until they're no longer usable. Same with the other issues. Various industries across the United States are looking to ramp up production. There was a recent article about a gene factory.
Yeah, and Detroit auto factories are talking about ramping up production. But what about the lag time? In the meantime, your docs are exposing themselves. We're hearing reports that doctors and nurses are being told to just clean a mask and use it over and over again. If the doctors get sick, they can't treat the patients.
That's an excellent point. So the concerns are, aside from just availability of these critical supplies, is those supplies are meant to protect the providers, the nurses and the physicians treating these people, both in the ER and in the hospital. If they get sick or exposed, now they're in quarantine isolation and they can't serve patients. Obviously, if they're sick, they can't serve patients. And these people putting their lives on the line. That would lead to potentially critical shortages of physicians to take care of individuals who are infected if they're sick. We're considering, VCMS is looking at possible options of trying to recruit retired physicians should that need arise. But then, of course, you're talking about a physician in an age bracket who's at a higher risk because they're elderly, over the 65 age. So this is a concern. We are, as an organization, seeking to source these masks. There are vendors out there who have them, the various PPE supplies, not just masks. We are, for the community physicians, we're sourcing them. So physicians, if need be, can engage patients to triage them to determine if they really need care. Keep in mind that the majority of patients exposed or infected with the virus do not have minimal symptoms. So These are individuals who should not be going to the emergency room. The majority of patients who may be infected do not need to go to the emergency room unless they have a significant respiratory difficulty, shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, and could potentially require hospitalization. There's no need to go to the emergency room. They're not going to test you. Testing isn't going to help the management. It's not going to change the outcome of the process. What you are doing by going to the emergency room is now you're utilizing more of this personal protective equipment because the individual at the emergency room needs to assume you have it until proven otherwise. So they're using their equipment to disengage you. And then also you yourself are potentially exposing yourself to people who are infected because now you're in a hospital environment with a higher concentration of potentially infected patients.
Okay, and if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. James St. George, president of the Duval County Medical Society, about the shortage of what's known as PPE, personal protective equipment, for doctors and hospital staff. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Join us. It's 549-2937. Doctor, have you heard of any local physicians or other healthcare workers getting sick with COVID-19 because they can't protect themselves?
I'm personally not aware of any physicians who are critically ill. There are physicians who may have not tested positive, but have been exposed. So they're in isolation. And if they're in isolation, of course, they're out of the system to be available to treat patients. I also understand that testing we hear every day the number of cases. The number of cases in Duval, the number of cases in Florida. These numbers are really not realistic, frankly. They are people who tested positive who happen to be tested. The majority of patients or individuals who are infected are not being tested. They either have minimal symptoms or no symptoms, but they still potentially are infected or carry the virus.
And so let me ask you then, what do you think needs to be done to increase testing availability and who should be getting tested? Do you think everyone should be getting tested?
I think in a perfect world, if the government had the number of tests available, then yes, really everyone would be tested at the same time. We would know who's infected and who's not. Those infected would be told to quarantine, and the course of this epidemic a pandemic would be significantly shortened. But the reality is that's not feasible at this time due to the
And how frustrated are you by that? The federal government has come under a lot of criticism for not getting out in front of this sooner. They were warned in January and again in February to prepare for a pandemic. They did not ramp up testing protocols. They did not respond aggressively as they were begged to do by the intelligence community. What about that?
Well, I think that's a true statement. The CDC made a number of missteps that resulted in us not having adequate kits available for testing. I think some of the issue relates possibly to the unavailability of adequate reagents necessary to process these tests. You can swab, but then you have to actually process the test, and there's certain chemicals and reagents necessary. I think the supply chain was disrupted through the globalization of this infection. Certainly some of those reagents came from China. Then there's the argument that we rely too much on Chinese manufacturing for critical medications and other products that are necessary to our daily lives here.
And let me ask you as well, before we go to callers, there are so many people out there who know how to sew, and they want to help. They want to make masks and get them to hospitals and healthcare centers. Should they do that, and how should they do? If so, how?
To be honest, I'm not really an expert on production of masks. I would suspect that, just thinking aloud, that you can't just use any piece of cloth, of course. So, you know, masks. Job is the purpose of provider wears a mask is, well, first of all, let me back up. There's the two type of masks. So the respirator mask, the one that prevents inhalation of small particles such as viruses and has an airtight fit over your face, cannot be made by a layperson. The typical surgical mask that you see people walking around with daily in the streets, or or a surgeon might wear during a procedure, they're designed for two reasons. One, if a surgeon is operating, of course, as I mentioned, you're not going to infect affect the wound in the operation. But from a provider treating a patient with coronavirus, the provider wears a mask to prevent an infected person from infecting the provider with the aerosol virus from their cough or breathing. Those kind of masks aren't really going to be as helpful to the provider because they're not an airtight seal on the face. So individuals making masks in the community, I'm not an expert on that, but I suspect the type of material, how permeable, how freely particles can enter it. You know, some material is loosely knit, some is very tightly knit. It would really depend on the material and the fit. It's not a question I can readily answer, but I'm not sure that would be helpful.
All righty. What do you think about the recommendation from Vice President Pence? On Sunday, he said that in coordination with the CDC and the Coronavirus Task Force, that some Americans who have been exposed to someone with the virus may be returning to work and that they could do so safely if they used a mask. Should Americans who are working from home continue to work from home, or should they go to work with a mask? Because these seem to be mixed messages that we're getting, and people are confused.
And I understand that. Unfortunately, this situation, as we all have witnessed, evolves daily, even if not hourly. There's recommendations and statements being made today are contrary to recommendations and statements made 2 weeks ago, and I'm sure that will continue. The only true preventive measure for spreading this virus is social isolation. We've heard this over and over. If an individual, say, is mildly symptomatic, has minimal symptoms, maybe a mild fever, they're not particularly ill, or even an individual who has no symptoms, doesn't know they're infected or not, the best public solution would be social isolation. Because if you stay home and let's say you're infected, you go 2 weeks, that virus will run its course in your body. You will no longer be the spreading virus, meaning you can no longer infect other individuals. And if many, many, many people in the country did that, then the rate of infection would dramatically reduce, because again, 80% of community spread of this virus is from people who are minimal symptoms or have no symptoms.
Okay. So following on that, Doctor, some governors and some mayors have issued shelter-in-place orders for their communities. Do you think Governor Ron DeSantis should do that? He's facing increasing pressure to follow in the lead of a few other governors and basically shut the state down, close all beaches, close all businesses except groceries and gas stations and pharmacies. In your professional medical opinion, should that be done in Florida?
Well, that's a question above my pay grade. That is a significant step, of course. We're talking about substantial impact to our society. You would probably have to bring in the National Guard to enforce that. And in fact, we're
talking about... the Guard has come into the state, but they haven't done anything like that yet.
Correct. You know, in the United States, while medically speaking, that could in fact significantly help, but implementing that on the vast scale of the entire state, mandating that people stay in their houses in the United States, I believe that would be a very difficult thing to do. But again, it's above my pay grade. Those kind of decisions are very complex. There's many ramifications to doing that. You know, certainly one hope on the horizon here is this is a seasonal virus. And we've had warm weather lately, well into the 80s. If this virus followed the same course of the flu as the weather warms up, the virus hopefully will abate.
But isn't it expected to have another wave in the fall? We've heard epidemiologists say that their big concern is that restrictions might ease up in the summer months, but it could come back roaring in the fall when our guard is down.
Well, keep in mind, we don't know. They're taking a position that if it follows the same epidemiology as the flu, where, you know, it's seasonal, it ramps up from the fall to winter and then abates and then repeats again and again year after year, that's certainly a concern. Perhaps as time goes on, there'll be more immunity throughout the country from the virus, which again, remember, 80% do not get critically ill.
So, and let me just let our folks know, we're having to reboot our phone system. I know a bunch of you were trying to get through. As we work on that, we ask you to email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweet the show at Melissa and Jax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. As we are taking questions right now for Dr. James St. George, he's president of the Duval County Medical Society. Here's a tweet for you, doctor, from Chris. I've seen talk of 3D printing ventilator parts, but wondering if there are files available of parts we know we will need. We've read about this, that ventilators that can be used in hospitals for patients can be made up on a 3D printer. Is that something that doctors are hoping can be done to ramp up production?
I think the country is looking at ramping up production of ventilators. You know, statistically speaking, we do not. If the amount of people were to become critically ill that they're afraid of, we wouldn't have enough ventilators to treat people who required it. As things stand now, intensive care units throughout the country. So it is true we could potentially require more ventilators. I don't think you can simply take a 3D printer and make a ventilator. There's many components to the ventilator. There's software control. There's electronics to it that regulate how much oxygen to give and how deeply to ventilate. So it's a complex device. That said, I believe the government is reaching out to manufacturers, just like we do in wartime, when in World War II, when Singer Sewing Company went from making sewing machines to making munitions. Just like that, with the War Act available in place, we can repurpose our private sector industry to ramp up, and the private sector is very mobile and flexible to be able to do that. So we're hoping that in a short time, that sector can produce the required number of ventilators. In addition, I believe the government does have equipment in reserve that they're beginning to make available to the various states who require it.
Do you think the president should mandate it through federal powers that he possesses, activate an act that would force factories and companies to get onto this sort of war footing and manufacture this equipment for doctors and patients?
Well, I think the free market is already doing that. I'm not sure if it requires, again, we're sort of stepping out my area of expertise here, but the free market will step up because the ability of a company to do what it's already doing in this economy during this virus is significantly reduced. So companies are repurposing. Not only are they serving the need to our country and the community by providing the needed materials, but they are also keeping their employees employed and keeping the economy going. So the free market will, I believe, handle that on its own without the need of government intervention.
Here is a tweet from Colleen. Do doctors need anything else? I could give them food, chocolates, anything for their families. I have no idea how to help, and I don't want to cause problems, but I will chip in any way I can. We just need guidance, she says.
Well, that's really sweet of her. Right now, physicians are okay. I don't think we are at that point. I think we're being cautious in looking at the potential needs for our resources and trying to anticipate the needs. But we're not in a position now where it's a problem. I don't think our society is in a position now where we don't have enough food or other issues like that. I think the best thing that people can do to help doctors, frankly, is don't panic. Stay at home. Don't go to the ER just because you're afraid you may have been exposed to someone with coronavirus. If you don't have severe symptoms of fever and respiratory difficulty, stay at home.
That's the best thing everyone can do.
Because if you go to the ER, you're overwhelming the system and you're using up more resources that we need for people who really, really are very, very sick.
Dr. James St. George is president of the Duval County Medical Society. Our phones are up and running again. You can connect with him right now with all your coronavirus questions. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Marilyn emails the show, what is the period of time between exposure to the infection and the appearance of the first symptoms? Doctor, isn't it? It can be as much as 2 weeks, can't it?
It can vary, but usually in general, the virus will run its course. Within 2 to 3 weeks. How quickly symptoms arise, it really depends on the individual. Certainly some patients are more immunocompromised. We hear about those individuals as being more susceptible to severe illness. So in those individuals, the virus could ramp up very quickly. In most people, they're exposed and they become, quote, infected. The body may be producing virus, but their immune system is able to keep it under control. So individually, they don't have significant symptoms or no symptoms, but they're still spreading virus.
All right, let's go to Raina in Jacksonville. She's on the line. Hi, Raina.
Without being tested.
Raina, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, without being tested. So is that the right protocol to follow? Shouldn't she be tested and confirmed that she's not positive?
And this is your mom? She's a physician?
She is.
And she has not been able to get a test yet?
No, the Department of Health is advising her not to get a test.
Okay, and you're worried, obviously, right?
Yes, I am very worried.
Sure. Okay, Raina, that's an excellent question. Dr. St. George, should physicians who are, we assume, are being exposed to the virus, at least what we're hearing, can't get a test. What about that?
Well, it really depends on the circumstances of that particular physician. You know, the DOH has, due to the limited supplies of testing kits, the DOH has screening criteria. And these are person who had close contact with a laboratory-confirmed coronavirus case. So if you're if your mother was a physician and she was known to treat or have exposure from a person who was later shown to be positive for coronavirus, then yes, she should be tested. Other criteria are persons hospitalized with severe lower respiratory illness.
Should the criteria be changed, though? Don't we have full community spread at this point? And if you're a physician and you're in a hospital working with all kinds of patients, you could be spreading it to more people.
And it's an excellent point. The reality of the situation is we don't have widespread testing available. And they're opening these drive-through testing areas, but you still have to meet the certain criteria. So, yes, we should have more testing. But the other problem with the testing is it takes, depending on the testing, who's doing it, could be as long as a week, 5 days to get the results. So you're tested, and then you're still going about your life, and could be positive, you may be negative.
Right.
Or you're negative at the time of the test, but then you go out interacting in the world, and 2 days later you're positive. So how is that helpful? What you should do is stay home.
And I think there's a lot of anger and frustration that privileged and connected people are getting access to the test, but the rest of us aren't. Senator Rand Paul just said he tested positive for the virus. He went to the Senate gym while he was waiting on his results. So other senators now have to self-quarantine. Lots of celebrities have gotten easy access to the tests, professional athletes. So what's your thought about that, the frustration the public is feeling that certain people are able to get the tests, but others are not, including doctors?
I really can't speak to that. I assume that Rand Paul, being a senator and having to help run our country, is critical. That's an individual important. We can't have the entire legislature infected and quarantined and not be able to run our country. In terms of celebrities, I don't know what they have access to and what they don't. I personally have not experienced that or seen that in terms of certain people having privileged access over others, but I can't speak to what goes on in Hollywood.
Let's go to Zach in Jacksonville. Zach, good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, my question is, if the actual number of cases is much higher than what's being reported with the test results, what does that say about the percent of severe cases and the percent of fatal cases? Aren't those numbers actually much lower too?
It's an excellent question. So I think it's a true statement. The actual number of cases out there is dramatically higher than being reported. Because remember, we're taking a very small sample of individuals in the country or state who've been tested, and that is not at all representative of the 80% of people who may be infected with minimal symptoms. So we're not really getting a true number of the patients out there who are infected. So certainly, yes, then the people dying of the disease, it is those we do know because they're in the hospital and they're being treated and they've been tested. So you're absolutely right. Certainly the percentage of mortality from this virus may be much lower than we believe, and the numbers range quite a bit from, you know, less than 1% all the way up to 20-30%. So we don't really have a good statistical analysis. All we can do right now is look at other countries who are smaller and were able to implement widespread testing and look at their data.
It's 549-2937. Michael is in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Michael, thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking my call. And doctor, thanks for appearing on the program. There are many millions of people in the country on blood pressure medication with normal blood pressure, thanks to the medication. They have no other history of heart disease. Are they included in the heart disease as a risk factor group?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, we're making sweeping groupings of people who are at risk. If you have heart disease and your heart disease is well managed with medications, such as blood pressure medication, your risk may not be as great as a person who has, say, undiagnosed heart disease or they're not being compliant with their medical management. Heart disease is one risk factor. Of course, there are many, you know, being as we get older, over the age of 65, our immunity is less. So these are it's multiple factors to determine your risk. But I think if you're taking your blood pressure medication and you're otherwise don't have any significant health issues, you should be fine.
Let's go to a few emails. Here is one from Patty. I'm a retired nurse practitioner, and I'm making face masks for the ER nurses at UF Health Jax. I'm following updated FDA guidelines for face masks, and I found a pattern on YouTube that is easy and effective, a small way we can help. This info came to me via an e-blast from my All-Star Quilters Guild. Thanks for that, Patty. Here's an email from a doctor. His name is Steve. I believe Americans should now be wearing homemade cloth face masks whenever they are out. Do you agree with that, doctor, or not?
I am not really sure of the answer to that. We've heard, at least the talking points to date have been that the face masks, these cloth face masks or surgical face masks that you see people wearing, the way they fit the face is not an airtight seal. So they could be helpful if you encounter an individual who coughed in your face or had close contact with who was infected. It's possible it may reduce some of the virus that you inhale, but remember the size of these masks are open. They don't fit snugly around the face. So you will still be breathing in potentially infected air droplets from a person you're in close proximity to. I don't think we have the data on that. This is unprecedented. We don't know if you did a study of a control group of people walk around in masks and expose them to the virus and those who didn't have masks, what those results would show. We don't know.
Here's an email. We are flying blind on this. You're right, for now anyway. Here's an email from Roger. What about the mailman? They open and close our mailboxes every day and handle pieces of mail. Does that pose a risk? And Amazon packages, plenty of those are coming to homes right now too, doctor.
So we read in the past that the virus can remain on surfaces such as cardboard. I think the duration of its viability on a surface was dependent upon the actual material that was with cardboard versus metal versus plastic. Early on, that was discussed. Again, it is something that is constantly being assessed. I haven't seen much of that in the literature lately, but that doesn't mean it's not a possibility. So hence the abundance of precaution about how to handle issues that people may have touched, you know, the wiping down of phones, etc. It is another area that we just don't fully comprehend and know the data. And unfortunately, getting this knowledge takes months and months of research and testing. I think they're dramatically improving our knowledge on a daily basis. All the researchers in the country are working through the night, literally trying to assess these issues, but a lot of it we don't know. That's a good question, but I don't have the answer.
Well, as we keep seeking the answers, we want to thank you, Doctor. Follow Dr. St. George's advice. Stay home as much as you possibly can. Do not go out into big groups. Stay 6 feet away from everyone. Wash your hands, especially if you're coming into the house from being outside. Every time you come into the house, wash your hands. And let's all try to flatten this curve together. Dr. James St. George, he's president of the Duval County Medical Society. Thank you, doctor, so much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Up next, isolated seniors in Florida nursing homes and their concerned families amid this outbreak. Some advice for you. That's next.
Electro Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
Florida has played a major role in the film industry. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the former Shamrock Studios in Winter Park. We'll discuss the United Spanish War veterans and catch up with Emma Dietrich from the Florida Public Archaeology Network. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, seniors in Florida are doing everything they can right now to protect themselves from coronavirus. They are most at risk. But many seniors are isolated, especially those in nursing homes. And there are new rules about visitation and how you can see your loved one. Steve Wattrell is an attorney with Coker Law who specializes in nursing home issues, and he's on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And you've been getting lots of calls from worried family members who have a loved one in a nursing home, and they've been separated from their families. Can you explain why?
Well, the main issue is that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a bulletin roughly 10 days ago banning all visitors and non-essential folks from going to nursing homes. Really, the only folks that can go in are the staff and then those dealing with end-of-life issues like hospice or pastors. So there's been a big limit on who can go into the facility. So that has created, obviously, a lot of fear and tension with family members.
Right. They want to check in on their mom or grandma or uncle or whoever it is. These are temporary restrictions, but it's still pretty unnerving, isn't it? Especially when we know that nearly two dozen nursing homes around Florida have been hotbeds of transmission of the virus.
Correct. Well, there's two issues here. First, the family members in many cases are the only social interaction these folks have, and many times they're also supplementing the caregiving of facilities. I mean, some facilities just don't have the staff to do more than see a resident every 2 hours. So the family members and loved ones are the ones that are helping turn and reposition, help with the bathroom, help with feeding, and it's really their only social interaction. So it's very important that family members are there. And you have to remember, a lot of these residents have a diagnosis of dementia, so not having social interaction, they get confused and, I think, worsen their situation.
So how do you advise people to connect with their loved ones virtually right now during this time?
Well, I think that the key is the facility should be proactive with reaching out to the family members, whether it be FaceTime, whether it be telephone, whether it be some other technology. But that should be a proactive process of the facilities to reach out to the loved ones saying, okay, we know you can't visit, but here's what we're doing to make sure that your loved one is not completely isolated, confused, worried, fearful, because that just makes the situation worse. And many facilities are doing that. I know River Garden is doing that, which is an excellent facility here in town. They've been very proactive, and many of them have been doing that.
Right. FaceTime is great. Zoom is great. There's all manner of ways to see your loved one's face and talk to them, which is comforting right now.
Correct. Correct. And you know, there's another issue that I think is concerning. It wasn't one I thought much about until someone brought it to my attention, but a lot of the staff, they're not on lockdown, so they're going in and out of facilities and not being tested, which could be a concern down the road. I think the facilities also need to be proactive that way, because you can lock down a facility for the residents, but if the staff's coming in and out and they're going to grocery stores and restaurants or wherever they're going, that could create a problem down the road. So the facilities need to be proactive with the staff and make sure that they're not compounding the problem.
And we're speaking with Steve Wattrell. He's an attorney with Coker Law who specializes in nursing home issues. If you have a question for him, it's 549-2937. So, Steve, what should people do if they suspect there's a problem at their loved one's facility during these restrictions and they can't get in to inspect things? They don't know how good the care their loved one might be getting because they can't do an unexpected drop-by. What should they do?
Well, I think first, obviously, I would recommend they try to work it out with the facility first, but if it's not being worked out to their satisfaction or there's no communication whatsoever, they can contact the Agency for Healthcare Administration and they can Google that and report it, or they could report it to the Department of Children and Families, which is the Elder Abuse Hotline, which is 1-800-96-ABUSE. I do want to say that I would encourage people to try to work it out first before they contact the state agencies, because I'm sure they're overworked. But by the same token, our concern doing what we do is that when this ban is lifted, a lot of stuff has gone on that, you know, we didn't have family members overseeing, and we're probably going to have quite a bit of problems. So if you're concerned and it's not being resolved to your satisfaction, those are the governmental agencies that can help you. And then to a lesser extent, the ombudsman. But I think DCF and ACCA are where family members would want to go.
Lane tweets us. She says, maybe it's time to send small groups of trios or quartets to carol outside the nursing homes. Yeah, what are ways people can comfort seniors that are so isolated, as you said? That's one creative idea, isn't it?
It is, you know, but the facilities have their own rule and regulations as to visitations and who could be on the premises. So, you know, we have to be sensitive, obviously, to this transmission of a virus that is very deadly to this population. So, yes, that is a solution. And if that's something that can be done safely, absolutely. And I think that's the same with family members. If something that is a solution to the issue, as you mentioned, the other technology as well.
And, you know, more than almost any other state, Steve, this is a big deal for Florida with our large senior population. You're hearing from a lot of families right now. What is the most common worry they're expressing to you?
Well, again, many of these folks have diagnosis of dementia. So they're isolated, they're afraid, they're fearful. And again, these family members are really the only social interaction they have. In many cases, it's a lot of the care they're getting too. I mean, the staff in many facilities, let's face it, they staff to the absolute minimums, and they just do not have the time to see the residents but every 2 or so hours. So, you know, with the family members there, they can be fed, they can be wheeled around, they could be taken to the bathroom, and I think the care is going to suffer. So I would be fearful if I was a family member as well. I mean, it's I do this every day, and I know how they operate, and it can be very stressful because you don't know what care they're getting or not getting. And we have some poorly performing facilities in town that have a poor history, and I would imagine that would get worse with no oversight.
We'll have more about this on our website today, and we want to thank you, Steve, for shining a light on it. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Steve Wattrell is an attorney with Coker Law in Jacksonville. He specializes in nursing home issues. And make sure to go to wjct.org/coronavirus for all the latest on the pandemic. Up next, with no sports on the field, what are fans to do? Well, Culpepper has some thoughts right after this.
New Horizons, offering IT programs designed to start your career in 3 months. Federal funding may be available. More information at newhorizons-jax.com or 564-9500.
Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good.
As the Affordable Care Act turns 10, available health care is more relevant for patients than ever.
I felt more in charge of my cancer than I ever felt about the insurance situation.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How did the Affordable Care Act change healthcare 10 years ago, and how's the coronavirus changing healthcare today? That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Florida has played a major role in the film industry. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will visit the former Shamrock Studios in Winter Park. We'll discuss the United Spanish War veterans and catch up with Emma Dietrich from the Florida Public Archaeology Network. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Andy called us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. For months, he's been geared up for spring break and the tourist dollars that it brings to the local economy. But
everything is just completely shut down. I just hope we can survive.
Who's still making payroll, and what help is there for those who can't? Your stories, plus the latest acts of kindness from around the country. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, without competitions on the field right now, where do sports fans get their fix? Hey, NFL fans still have free agency.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper is on the line in this first week of the NFL free agency. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, thank goodness we have something to talk about with regard to sports, because otherwise, it'd be pretty thin right now, but the Jaguars during the first week of free agency, answering some glaring questions. Now the big question is, how good are those answers? That remains to be seen. The signing of middle linebacker Joe Schobert from the Browns allows the Jaguars to move Miles Jack back to outside linebacker, where he was more of a playmaker prior to moving the middle after the 2017 season. I think Schobert could be a good addition. He's not Paul Pozlewski, but maybe he can be some version of Puz White, perhaps. The other moves are basically role players, not stars, and they are replacing stars, so we'll see how it goes. Cornerback Darquez Bernard and defensive lineman Rodney Gunter can help the Jaguars defense, but they are not at the level of players they're replacing A.J. Boye and Calais Campbell, so value pricing for the Jaguars in a lot of this free agency here in the first week. And think about this, the Jaguars defense was so dominant back in 2017, earning the nickname Saxonville. Now has only Miles Jack and Avery Jones remaining in the starting rotation. That is assuming Yanni Ngakoue does not play anymore. He is tagged as the franchise player. But the Jaguars are certainly in a rebuilding mode. It's a youth movement, and it's almost a total rebuild, which makes the next two drafts even more important for the future of the team. And if the Jaguars were to line up today, certainly they'd still have some questions about the defensive front. We'll see how that all plays out. I think the draft is going to be big for that. And then on offense, the tight end position is still lacking. There are questions about the offensive line. And although the receiving core has some young potential like DJ Chark and D.D. Westbrook, they can still upgrade that position. I mentioned the draft. The Jaguars have 12 draft picks in the upcoming draft, including two first-round selections, the 9th and 20th picks. Going into the draft, the Jaguars' top names, I'd say, are defensive line, tight end, and cornerback, and the offensive line again. But also use some more competition.
And we're having a little trouble hearing you, Cole. So as we follow this, let's talk about the other stuff that you normally get into every Monday on this show, like NASCAR. They're not racing in person, but they're still kind of doing something. What is it?
Yeah, the e-racing series has existed for some time in NASCAR, but yesterday it was the front and center on television for the first time ever, as the guys from 35 different races from across all the three national series had these basically trumped-up video game setups in these garages and their houses and ran a virtual race at the virtual Miami Homestead Raceway. Denny Hamlin wound up winning, but it was interesting to watch because in the first 20 or 25 laps, some of those guys maybe not quite as attuned to how to drive a virtual car versus an actual car. But they had the whole broadcast team calling the thing. I'm not going to say it had the exact feeling of watching a race, but at least it mimicked it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
For a week, it was something to see for the for race fans. I don't think we're probably going to see this replace NASCAR completely, but for now, This is what we have.
Hey, it's something. Now, Cole, you also say another way fans are getting their fix is by watching old games that are being rebroadcast.
Yeah, CBS yesterday rebroadcast a bunch of former NCAA college basketball championship games, including the 2008 Kansas-Memphis national championship game won by the Jayhawks in overtime, close to my heart, of course, of my alma mater. Because we just have not had anything to cheer for, some, I think, energetic Kansas fans in Lawrence, where KU is located, after the broadcast, took to the main street downtown, driving up and down the street, honking horns as if the Jayhawks had just won the national championship. Hey, they were the number one team this year at the end of the year. Just yearning for some sense of normalcy in the wake of the coronavirus, the shutdown. There are schools, teams, leagues all across this country that are looking for some kind of outlet to celebrate.
Oh, sure. And anything at all. And there's more bad news. The Olympics may not go forward. Is that right?
Yeah, there were two big developments yesterday as far as the Summer Olympics in Tokyo are concerned. They're scheduled for July, but Canada announced that they would not be sending a team unless the Olympics were pushed back by at least a year to 2021. Now, Canada is not exactly the biggest voice in international athletics, but one of the biggest voices did speak up yesterday, Sebastian Coe, who's the head of the ruling body of international track and field, saying that he was citing a number of different concerns, wanting the postponement of the games. Two of the things that really jump out right now for athletes is they don't know when they can train properly and if they can travel safely to Tokyo with the coronavirus concerns. So I think we're getting closer, Melissa, to a situation where they are going to push it back, but it's going to be at least a month before they make that call.
We'll watch it, and you can catch Cole every night on Channel 4, our news partner. Follow him on Twitter, at Cole Pepper. There is still sports to talk about, and he will be your man for that. Cole, always good to see you and virtually see you today. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Palumbo is WJCT's news director, and our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. Keep that feedback coming. We really want to hear from you, especially now. It's First Coast Connect at WJCT.org to connect with us. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Flatten that curve and keep calm. We will all get through this together.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.